we didn't get a classical education. This is something new to us. We're going to have to reconstruct this whole thing. And that does require some humility on our part.
Welcome to Classical Etc. You're in the studio with Memoria Press.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Classical Etc. I'm Jessica Gardner, and I am joined today by our usual guests, Martin, Tanya, and Paul.
Here we are, usual again.
The normal.
Last week it was normal.
Oh, and now it's usual.
Just the average folks. Casual.
That's the first time anyone's ever called me normal.
Oh, well, it probably is.
Yeah. Oh.
I feel, makes me feel good though.
Don't get used to.
Try not
one
to.
Compliment a week.
Right. If I'm lucky.
Well, on today's episode, we are going to be discussing the liberal arts, why they matter, what they are, and why we teach them. But before we get into that, what is everyone reading? Tanya, we were talking about it before we started recording.
We were. So I'm still where I was last week. But I do have Middlemarch now. So that is what I'm getting ready to start. And it turns out I read it in college and I haven't read it since, which is shocking to me because I am a huge George Eliot fan and I've read everything else she's written. So it's time to reread this. But the book that I got is 900 pages. So it's huge.
Yeah, when y'all went,
it's like Daniel Deronda.
I wasn't at the War and Peace discussion, and then when you come out the next morning and reading Middlemarch, I'm like, what are you all doing?
What are we doing? There are no short books.
Don't you try to read a small one in between the big ones?
Well, we usually do. I'm not sure what happened to us. We were just all like, yes, Middlemarch. I've been wanting to read that. That's on my list.
So you keep saying, yes, Middlemarch.
Middlemarch is a good illustration to me of how watching a dramatization of something can really ruin something for you.
Oh, because I'm not going to do that then.
There was a PBS dramatization of Middlemarch that I think was back in the 90s or something, and it ruined Middlemarch. I went and read it, but that image, the imagery from the movie stuck with me.
Oh, you really had watched it before you read it.
Yes, before I read it, and that was...
You should read it again with us.
Well, it's kind of long.
It is.
What are you reading, Martin?
I'm trying to finish up.
Do you have time? You have time to read Middlemarch if you're not reading much else.
Right. I'm reading about 12 different things. So.
Well, let's not listen to them
all. Is not
Tell us
one.
One
of them.
Tell us one.
Well, The Conquering Tide, which I mentioned before, I'm finally, this is the second in the trilogy by Ian Tolles about the Pacific War in World War II. And very, very well done. These character sketches of these great generals, Admiral Halsey and some of these other generals, is just an amazing character study. That what makes a leader, and you really gets down to brass tacks in terms of why one person can lead men and others cannot. It's just very interesting. And then I've gotten back to Death Comes to the Archbishop.
Oh, I thought you'd finished that.
No, I haven't.
How do you drop a book and pick it back up months later? I would have to start at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I would have to start at the beginning again. We just did Cheryl Swope's essays that the Memoria College Press is going to publish. And we had read them over the course of a couple of months because none of us has time to sit and read all day. And it was hard to remember then when you get in a meeting, and they're all short, but you pick up a book after months and just start where you left off.
I did with that one, actually. I went back and read things that I had read before, but it just depends on what it is. On a novel, I think it's easier for me to pick up.
Right. If you've got the synopsis of it still in your head.
And it depends like how many characters there are in that novel.
But now we're doing Rallying the Really Human Things by Vigen Guroian that we're going to publish. Mm-hmm. So we're all reading that, right?
Yes. Right?
And I don't know that I thought I had read that one before. I don't think I did.
Well, you better get on it.
I read the foreword or preface or something.
I've read 20 pages. I'm doing 20 pages
ahead
a day.
Ahead of me, then.
If you do 20 pages a day, you'll make it.
What's the title again?
By the date, Rallying the Really Human Things.
It's gone out of print.
And so we're going to republish it.
Vigen Guroian, for those who don't know, who is a professor at memoriacollege.org.
Oh, great. Today he's actually got
He's got a brochure with him.
Are you going? You want to read it to us? Please, sure. What are you reading, Paul? Okay.
I actually made no progress on The Red Pony by Steinbeck, but it's only a 3-hour book. You'd think I'd get through it. But no, Boethius is for my class. Mm-hmm. Constellation of Philosophy is just, you know, it's not my first time through it, but every time it is so good.
So yeah, when you're reading for a class, that takes your reading time.
Now, are you teaching it, or are you taking the memoriacollege.org class?
I actually have written my own curriculum for this text,
which we're going to have study guides for. Paul has promised me study guides after he finishes teaching. So I'm thinking end of May I'll have the teacher.
Oh goodness
guide.
Gracious! No, I just told you the other day I'm taking like a week or two in June and finishing writing.
Okay.
It all.
That's okay. End of June.
I'm recording videos as we go through. So
those will be done.
Those will be close to done.
And that's your metaphysics class?
Yes. I think we've titled it Classical
Philosophy. He's renamed
philosophy.
It how many philosophy. Times? It About went three, from twice. Metaphysics yeah, to Introduction to Philosophy and now
Classical Philosophy.
Classical Philosophy.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Boethius.
Boethius. It's so good. Well, and one of the things I love about it is he's struggling with the idea of free will and providence. How do those two things go together? Because he's struggling with the problem of evil. And that same problem, the free will and providence, is the problem in The Count of Monte Cristo. Hmm. And so it's like a philosophical side of the issue that I love in The Count of Monte Cristo.
I would say it was the same in War and Peace, but there seems to be no free will in
fate.
War and Peace. It is all providence,
yeah.
fate.
Yeah.
Hmm. Oh, now,
how the
wait
cards
a minute.
Fall.
But his whole view of war is that it's much more the product of chance than it is the planning
right.
of the generals.
That's what I'm saying.
Go toward. You said free will versus
that there's no,
it's all fate. It's all fate. Like
I took it the opposite way.
So this is what Martin should have been in the book discussion. That would have,
no, it's just these random decisions that get made and there's no
right.
providence. I guess I took the generals trying to dictate what happens on the battlefield. That fails. It's the providence in that sense embodied in the, what's happening.
Chance
in the book.
Chance to me is fate. Mm. No?
No, it's there.
Boethius would agree with you, actually. Boethius would agree with you on that, I think.
Well, this would be a great discussion.
I was going to say.
Well, free will versus determinism?
Yes, and okay. Tolstoy's all about determinism.
That was
not free will. I know. So now you've cleared things up.
I wish I did like the, it was done in a Woody Allen movie where he gets in there, either in a movie line and they get an argument about what Marshall McLuhan, the great writer about communication, said about something. And Woody Allen's in there, he's getting mad at this guy because he's clearly wrong. He says, hold on just a minute. He goes off stage and he pulls Marshall McLuhan in, actually there. And Marshall McLuhan looks at the guy and says, you're entirely wrong about my works. And then he just walks off stage. Which is, of course, impossible, but I would love to be able to do that. Just pull in
Tolstoy
right now.
And then have him tell Tanya that she's mistaken about.
Hold on. Can we just clear this? Because I'm legitimately confused, and I feel for our listeners. You don't believe that in War and Peace, Tolstoy was trying to make the point that everything that happens in this world is dictated for us. And that whatever we choose to do will have no impact on the outcome of what happens in the
world.
I
think it depends probably on how you look at it, because what I took from his whole description of the Napoleonic War, which Napoleon invades Moscow, was that the decisions of the generals who are trying to impose their will on the battle, so symbolically, that's determinism, and that fails. And instead, it's just these chance happenings that dictate the outcome of a battle, which is chance. So there, I guess you could argue there's some overarching thing in the book, philosophy, but in terms of the symbolism of what's going on, the symbolism is very much in the that chance prevails over determinism.
Yeah, but he has long sections on how determinism is the only way to understand how those things actually happen.
Well, then it may be an example of how an author is wrong about his own book.
I think I thought when I was reading that, that what he was saying about all those individual decisions is that they really amounted to nothing, that it was all determined.
Right. Those things happen because it had to be that way.
Right.
That's not the way I tell you. I thought the symbolism of the book was actually...
it would be nice to be able to ask
him. I feel like
him,
this is like a prime example of where the literature teacher is imposing his reading on the text instead of actually asking, what does the text say?
What does it say? What does it mean?
I mean, he does have that whole second epilogue is all about chance and all those individual decisions that were made. But... And maybe I need to go back and read it again, but I thought the point he was making was that in the end, none of those decisions mattered.
I haven't finished it, so when I finish it,
okay, then we can have this discussion again. So we are way off in the weeds.
We will come back.
Sorry.
Paul, you finish War and Peace.
Yes.
We'll come back to it.
Sounds good.
Okay. But for today's episode, the liberal arts. And Martin, I want to start with you. Just give us a brief, clear explanation of what are the liberal arts, just so we're all on the same page as we begin this discussion.
Well, first of all, the term the liberal arts is the expression arts means some kind of skill or capacity or ability on the part of a student. Liberal is a reference to the fact that these are the arts of a free person. In the classical sense, who's not a slave, basically, any free person. And those differ from the manual arts, which have to do with, you know, things you do by hand, manus in the Latin, and the fine arts, which are arts that are pursued for their own end. They're an end in and of themselves. When you do music, when you do painting, those are things you do purely for their own sake, not for anything else, not as a means to anything else. Whereas the liberal arts, there is a means. It's the things you need to know to govern yourself and to govern yourself individually and as a society. And those have traditionally been seven, the three linguistic arts and the four mathematical arts. So grammar, logic, and rhetoric were the linguistic arts. That was called the trivium. And then there were the other four mathematical arts, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. And those are different from the sciences, which are the bodies, organized, systematic bodies of knowledge that you study.
So when I went to a liberal arts college and studied humanities, I thought I was studying the liberal arts.
Yes. And the usage of that term has come for some reason to apply to the humanities, so that's the way it's used. All those books that came out two or three years ago about the liberal arts were being used in that way. Mm-hmm. They were referring to the sciences, actually, the human science.
Yeah, but here's the thing, right? You can't create a perfect division between skills that you master and content that you learn. And so when we're talking about the linguistic arts of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, at some point, you have to practice that
within
the context. And traditionally, I mean, you go back to the Middle Ages, so you go look at the Jesuits, Ratio Studiorum, or whatever plan of studies, they're doing that in the humanities and literature and history. That's where they're practicing, you know, whatever your written communication, your oral communication, how you can put those concepts together to form an argument. Can you be persuasive in that argument? Those are the skills of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, but then they get
applied.
Exercised and applied in the humanities. But then what ended up happening for whatever reason over the past century is that the reason that we were using the literature and history for application became primary over we need to acquire skills too.
Mm. And they're distinct, but not separate.
Does that coincide with the loss of classical education that we lost? We lost the idea. I mean, I did definitely have a good humanities education in college, a very, very good humanities education, but nobody ever mentioned the trivium or the quadrivium to me. And nobody ever, I mean, I'm just thinking, did my college, which is now a university, did they even know what liberal arts were when they called themselves a liberal arts college?
I think they, I think when the college was founded, they knew what it meant. Mm-hmm. And in my school, which your son went through this, right? The interdisciplinary courses that they had, when I found this was a course that they required every year, was an interdisciplinary course. And when I went and read the justification for it, I almost laughed.
Oh, I just got mad because this was my money right. paying for this ridiculousness.
Right. But when you looked at their rationale, they said, we found that our students were not able to communicate effectively or reason well at the end of their college career. And so we needed to put in some form of a class that required them what? To practice the basic skills of grammar, logic, and rhetoric.
Uh-huh, through social media.
Well, then the way they actually applied that was funny. But I thought, you're a liberal arts college. All you need to do is actually apply the liberal arts in every one of your classes. It's not hard.
Right.
But this is important because what Tanya said, because if you hear that expression, it's the definition she's talking about. It's not really the traditional definition. And I think your point about, was this a result of the decline of classical education? I actually think it was, because those distinctions were much more prominent. If you go back and look at A Defense of Classical Education, the book out by Memoria College.
.org. Got it.
In our press, that's when he talks about things in there, he's talking about them in that old sense, mm-hmm. in a way that we don't use anymore.
We don't recognize. And no, I mean, I think I bet you I could go onto that university campus right now and nobody would know.
Mm-hmm. What the liberal arts are. Right. Well, right. And also, like, if we would say that the best way to teach grammar is through learning Latin, right? And in a holistic sort of classical education context, the liberal arts are there, but we're doing that through Latin. If you know Latin, the artes liberales, or the liberal arts, in the way we mean it, makes a whole lot more sense. All of a sudden, when the etymology starts to fall apart, mm-hmm. that's when words start getting used in ways that they don't actually mean, because nobody actually knows where those words come from.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Good point. It's a good point.
But I also like to think of the liberal arts not only as the arts of the free person, but the arts that free.
Mm, now, right. Free the person. Right. They free you.
Yeah. Not necessarily the exact etymological intent there.
No, I'm not sure that it's not. I mean, I think that's a good point. And so if you were living in classical times when slavery was prevalent, for example, in Rome and in Greece, a slave, you would not want a slave to get the liberal arts, because it would fit him to become something that you don't want him to be, you know, the people mm-hmm. back in that time. And so unless you were, you know, in Greece, for example, many of the tutors were slaves. Mm-hmm. So in that case, it just becomes something that
a tool you for want them.
That, a tool right. for
so
them
they were educated.
The
tutors.
The tutors were, mm-hmm. yes, yes. But, you know, in teaching grammar, logic, rhetoric, music, astronomy,
geometry,
and astronomy, mm-hmm. then that's what's really helping your reason fire sort of on all fronts, right? On linguistic right. and mathematical fronts, and mathematical in both the quantitative the discrete quantitative and the continuous quantitative fronts. And so then you can apply that to any of the content areas. Mm-hmm. And so when you have those skills is when you really are free to...
Because then you can do anything.
You can do anything.
And you can study anything.
And any mm-hmm. of the information coming to you, you can piece that through, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have... Like, you can really fully reason through whatever sort of sales pitch, whatever
right.
The media is trying to tell you, any of that sort of stuff, because you've been given all the tools to analyze that and say, okay, what arguments are being made? What kind of persuasive tool are they using? You know, do these numbers even make sense, right? Like the games people play with statistics.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's all of that by having a student master those skills, you've really freed them.
Yeah, and this is, I think, very underappreciated in our world, is the kinds of skills that these subjects teach, because we want to specialize. You know, we think that in order that the best thing to do for a student to fit them for their career in business or technology or something is these specialty skills that they use, when in fact, what the liberal arts are teaching you are these general skills that you use in everything. Mm-hmm. And I hear this from my children, two of whom are senior software engineers who got a classical education. And my oldest son, you know, has told me a number of times, well, you know, I mean, studying Latin helps you, just because you learn the grammar and the syntax, which is what you're using in programming language. And if you already know those kinds of general skills before getting into the actual language, then you can master a whole bunch of different languages, as he has. So that's the thing that I talk about a lot when I'm giving talks, is this sort of forgotten idea that what the liberal arts were for was to fit you to do anything.
Mm. That was the very first thing that Cheryl Lowe said that actually clicked with me and made me want to do this, mm-hmm. or want to give this to my children, was that it would fit them for whatever. It didn't matter what, but they would internalize mm-hmm. all of these skills and then be able to do whatever they did well. Mm-hmm. And as good citizens and morally. And
why wouldn't you do that instead of specializing in one particular thing, which fits you to do that one particular thing?
Well, the problem with that too is I may be wrong about this, but how many of us are doing what we went to college mm-hmm. to do? When you have to make a decision in seventh grade, what you want to do for your life, what would mine have been? Maybe in... airline stewardess or something. I mean, it would have just been ridiculous,
Tanya,
when I was 13.
It would amuse you to know that my first major was business economics.
Was it? Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, mine was English, but it was only because I loved to read those books.
And I mean, to be fair, right? Like if seventh grade is a little longer, but like if you ask every young boy you made them follow their whole pathway, they'd all be astronauts or superheroes, right? Like, I mean, when we're young, we don't fully know.
We don't know
what we want to do.
Well, and we haven't left it open. If we really minimalize the things that students are exposed to, then we're not really leaving. It's not fair, because we don't know really what God intends for their lives. Mm-hmm. And so if we give them a liberal education, then they are more likely to be able to fulfill that purpose, whatever it is. And nobody knows that when they're young, when they're children, they don't know. I mean, my son hated Latin. Every day we fought about Latin. But it was a huge gift to him. Yeah. So if I had let him decide what he was going to be, then he wouldn't have taken Latin. If I had said, you know, when he was, well, of course he started very, very young, but it just wasn't, there are just things students need to do. They all need one set of things to do, one set of things to learn that is general.
And Tanya, I'd be curious to hear your answer. Could a parent using materials at home who wasn't classically educated, or, you know, could they feasibly provide their child with a classical education?
Oh.
Not having a background in the liberal arts.
Sure. I mean, I did it I had a horrible high school education and public school. It was awful. Like, the football coach taught advanced math. I made an A. There was no math going on in that classroom. I've made an A in chemistry and physics. And you all know should not have happened. It was awful, but I wanted, and that's why I knew that I wanted more for my children, because I knew when I went to college that I was not prepared for college at all. And it just, I'd been really done a disservice in my education. But we, you know, we've worked, that was one of Cheryl Lowe's missions, is and a lot of curriculum companies now are mm-hmm. all working, because we are, this is a growing movement, and we all do feel like this is the thing to do, classically educate children. And so we've tried to make it as easy as possible, but in our curriculum, and that mm-hmm. is the place to start, is mm-hmm. just to study with your children. Mm-hmm. But also, you really need to go beyond that. You mm-hmm. do need to be reading. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you've never read the Iliad and you've got a second grader, it's time to read it. Mm-hmm. The college.org, the college classes mm-hmm. are very good. Even if you just take one, like we have a teacher mm-hmm. who took the children's literature course because mm-hmm. she just had never read those books and she really enjoyed it. And it makes you feel more equipped mm-hmm. to be doing something like that.
Well, and just to have programs. I mean, the way Cheryl wrote and wanted other programs of ours to be written is to be almost self-instructive, that you have all the tools there. You don't, all the things that a teacher would have to know are embedded in the book and in the lessons themselves.
And you really do learn it and with you really, them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and the best way to learn is to teach. Mm-hmm. And my wife did this. I think a lot of the people who use a Memorize program do this too. And we go to these conferences. We're right in the middle of conference season right now. And to talk to all these mothers who have used these programs, and I keep saying this, but one of the greatest education revivals going on right now is parents who are teaching their children this material. And they realize this is what's going on, not at first, but after a while, they realize that they're learning all the stuff they did not learn in school, and they're excited about it, and they want to pass it on. And a lot of them, when they're finished teaching their own children this stuff, they go looking for some place to teach because they've got all this knowledge now, and they want to mm-hmm. use it, and they're excited about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not one of these things where it's like the blind leading the blind. Mm-hmm. The parents really are learning the material to then teach it to their students.
Right.
And so sometimes you think, well, how can I give what I don't have? And my mother always says, she's like, I learned more teaching you all than I ever knew. Mm-hmm. And it's huge.
I mean, when I taught the first year I taught and I was teaching fifth grade, I was teaching every single subject. So it meant it was a lot of work. And I did some prep work in the summer. I did what I could. But as I was teaching, I literally spent weekends having to study the lessons that I was going to teach mm-hmm. the following week or even the night before, just, you know, to reread a famous Men of the Middle Ages lesson and look, you know, research the character that I was teaching. It's hard. I'm not mm-hmm. going to say it's easy, but mm-hmm. it absolutely can be done and mm-hmm. should be done. Nothing that shouldn't hold anybody back. Mm-hmm. The lack of education of their personal education, just sure. because you can educate yourself with your children. Mm-hmm. And what we're asking the children to do is a lot of stuff that we never had. Mm-hmm. Unless we were classically educated ourselves, and you're not going to find a lot of those people.
And the criticism comes sometimes that well, you know, you need a qualified teacher to teach, and people have just the most inaccurate estimation of what really happens in schools. I mean, you were talking about your coach teaching. Mm-hmm. My composition teacher in high school was Mr. Phillips, and he was a coach. And not that I was any great student in the composition class. In fact, he'd probably be turning over in his grave if he found out I turned into a writer. But he was a terrible teacher. And people think that teachers are necessarily qualified if they get a job in something. And
right.
for the most part,
they're not.
They're not doing the thing they were trained to teach, if they were trained at all
right.
really in that subject anyway. So yeah. Just pointing that out.
Yeah. Paul, here's a question for you. If someone wants to pursue studying the classics, classical works, whether they want to just for personal enrichment or to teach their students, their children, do they have to use additional resources like books and guides, or can they just go to the original source classic?
Well, if the parent is educated enough that they can pull out the Iliad in Greek and teach out of the Greek, by all means, right? but most of us aren't, right? I mean, there is an entire movement that has sprung up, and it's fascinating when you go to these conferences Martin's talking about, the people that are out there that have resources for sale are precisely doing that because they were trying to educate their children and saw that there wasn't a resource available that they needed. And they went and they educated themselves on it. And then they wrote something that they used for their family, and they've turned around making that available to other people. And so, yeah, I mean, the reality is, yeah, sure, you can go online and download stuff and print it out on your, you know, download the original text, you know, whether, or
even a translation.
Or a translation from the 1800s mm-hmm. or something and print it out. But the reality is all those things, a lot of ways, it makes teaching harder because the language is so old, right? Like even the Sam Butler translation of the Iliad and the Odyssey we use, like if you go get the original, it's got the Roman gods' names in it. It's confusing to the student, but why we got Roman gods' name? We're talking about it's a Greek work. And so the resources that are out there, you can do without them if you really know your stuff, but they're there to just make your life easier. Right. Right. When you are doing that prepping, like Tanya was talking about the night before, that you don't have to read the whole thing super carefully and then make notes in the margins and all that sort of stuff, because you've got something that's going to help you through it.
Yes. Especially if you haven't had time to read through the entire thing. So if you haven't actually read through the Iliad, then how are you really going to know what the themes are, what you should be pulling out for the students? And so that work has been done for you. Mm-hmm. With a study guide. It was very helpful to me when my kids were doing, like, I'll say Homer, since that's what we've been talking about, but just to have that extra help to know that somebody else had already fleshed all this out for me. So then I could learn alongside, but I could also teach because I had that extra help.
Yeah, and I mean, I was just also thinking, for some reason, flashcards popped in my head because I remember my mother finding my Latin flashcards when I was an adult, and it just chicken scratch. She was like, "You want me to say this?" I was like, "No, pitch them." but you know, with the two kids, foster kids we have in our home right now, like we noticed, like one, we really should be working with her on arithmetic, and so we need flashcards, right? Like we could sit down and write out all the facts, right, you know, on pieces of paper and go with that, but then it's never going to get done. And so having something where I could say, "Okay, hey, look, I need to spend $10, $15 on a pack of flashcards,"
and that we can use every day.
And immediately we can go home and start.
That's
right. Well, there's this romanticist attitude out there that we can do all this stuff on our own. And we just need to be humble and realize that there's stuff we don't know. And then what we're doing is engaging in a revival of something. It needs to be revivified. New life has to be put into it. In order to do that, none of us got, well, you got more of it than any of us, but we didn't get a classical education. This is something new to us. We're going to have to reconstruct this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And that does require some humility on our part.
And the other thing about that is we've been saying anybody can do this, but the fact is you really can't do it all well. It's the rare person who can do it all well. Mm-hmm. I could teach my children to write, but I know a lot of people who could not look at, I had parents of students who couldn't look at their child's paper and see what it needed, how it needed to be fixed. I could never have taught pre-cal or chemistry despite my A in high school. I mean, I wouldn't have done my children a good service. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have gotten what they needed. So sometimes you do have to outsource, and
that's where Memoria Academy.
That's right. I mean, the online academy for the classes that you need. Now, little kids, you can teach everything, It's all on, certainly on an adult level that you should be able to teach. But really, by the time they get to upper level math and science, or even, you know, some people don't feel qualified to teach Dante. But if you don't want to use the online academy too, you can generally find a class on the college site that will teach you so that you can teach your children, right? You have classes on like Dante, and yeah, I know you've got Shakespeare. You've had Jane Austen. So there's all kinds of resources out there. And so I do think we have to be confident that we can do it, but also humble enough to know when we're limited and can't get beyond those limitations without hurting our children's education.
And I think if the desire to just use the original texts that are out there is coming from sort of this purist idea of like, well, in the 1600s, all they had was the original texts, right? The reality is they had mechanisms in place to teach students how to read, how to give them, you know, lesser things before they got to more things, right? And the teachers that were teaching were people that had been specifically trained in this. And so we shouldn't look at the past as this, as something where you've got seventh
like
graders
they did it, so
all
we should
sitting
be able
together
to do it.
At, you know, reading Homer's Iliad together in Greek. You might have had pockets of that.
But they had an apparatus which has been lost over time that we are trying to reconstruct.
Right. And maybe one day we'll get back to it. You know, but for now, everybody, the thousands, tens of thousands of people that are teaching, trying to teach kids classically need the resources that are available.
Good discussion on the liberal arts, what they are, and how we can move forward in training our children in them, even if we didn't receive them. So good discussion. You can find any of our materials that we've discussed, our lesson plans, our study guides, at memoriapress.com. And don't forget those classes as a parent that you can attend, memoriacollege.org.
And student classes at memoriaacademy.com.
I knew that
was coming.
Got
it all there. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us today on Classical Etc. by Memoria Press. If you like what you heard, you can follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. To learn more about Memoria Press, please go to memoriapress.com. This has been Classical Etc. We're so glad you joined us, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Memoria Press Podcast Network, providing a classical Christian perspective on the world of education. To learn more about Memoria Press, visit us at memoriapress.com. To connect with us, find us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.